What a piece of luck. We start our election campaign today.
Elections? In this place?
Of course, we make our choice every 12 months. Every citizen has a choice. Are you going to run?
Like blazes, the first chance I get.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Jeremy Corbyn makes it clear, if Trump doesn't behave, it's time to say goodbye to the US special relationship. And we zoom in on Labour's foreign policy now, as the Kurds vote to secede from Iraq this week too, and Catalonia voting on Sunday around Barcelona, despite the best efforts of Madrid to stop the referendum on whether or not to leave Spain. We ask, have we the people seen through the centralisation of power going on in the West? With leaders who use their own intelligence for their own personal gain, however incompetent they are, they're promoted to the top. Like the rejection of Brussels in Brexit or the US failure to force regime change in Damascus, the beginning of the end of the New World Order in the West, and the War of Terror. Also, Trump this week tweaks condemnation of an Iranian missile test that never happened. And amid mounting military and diplomatic tensions between America and Russia, the German daily Süddeutsche Zeitung is reporting the American Congress has taken the first steps towards Washington's annulling of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Hardly reported, that one. Our sister show Dialects back again on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week we hear from two people who believe they've been helped where doctors failed by Bristol Healing Rooms at City Road Baptist Church. Also, Britain's greatest investigative blogger you've never heard of, Michael Tyler. His article detailing the now nearly 80 murders of bankers in the last 3 years that went uninvestigated by the police. But you won't find him on Google, no. They've erased his blog from their index under their new April algorithm introduced earlier this year on Hitler's birthday. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect, or if you can't wait, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, what have you been looking at this week?
Well, I've been trying to follow what's been going on in Syria and in Korea, really.
Isn't it all over in Syria?
No, not really. Unfortunately, there was a Russian general killed this week in Syria, supposedly a lucky shot from ISIS, but the Russians have already suggested that ISIS were given the coordinates of their general by US drones or some other mechanism of that sort. And they also gave a press conference where they showed that US military embedded with the Kurdish plus forces were basically allowing ISIS to moving through ISIS lines. So in other words, the Russians are beginning to suggest quite openly that the West is supporting ISIS, and there have been exchanges of fire between Russian and US aligned forces. So there's a potential for a war between Russia and the US, and that's hardly been reported in our media.
What about these moves by Congress to get the United States to pull out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty? We've heard virtually nothing about this, but it's yet another treaty. I mean, I try and report these on this programme, but one by one, the treaties which have kept the peace during the Cold War and deterrence and mutually assured destruction, it seems are being torn up by the West.
That's right, and of course they've also put missiles into Romania and into Poland, which are incredibly threatening to the Russians, because people say, well, all they're just there to deal with to defend the West. In fact, the justification for having these missiles there is to defend against Iran, which is absurd, but there you go. But of course, if you've got missiles placed on somebody's border and then you carry out a first strike against them, those missiles are there to knock down the second strike, or possibly even to carry out a first strike. So as you say, mutually assured destruction is gradually being undermined by the desire of the militant faction in the US to fight and win a nuclear war. And it may sound crazy to our listeners, you can't fight and win a nuclear war, but that's what they're talking about. And the only thing that's stopping this from escalating further is the common sense of both the Chinese and the Russians. They still believe in mutually assured destruction.
Trump has already
said, you know, you attack us, we will attack you. That's
Trump
all
has
we'll
endorsed
say.
This week this program, which was started by Obama, to modernise, he calls it, upgrade, I would call it, all of America's nuclear weapons, and it's going to cost nearly $1.5 trillion. Trump's saying, yes, this is something we need to do, and we need to do it now.
Yes, and he's also cutting taxes for the wealthy. How are they going to balance the books, Tony? Although, no, we're in military land now, so we don't have to balance the books.
Well, hang on, because there is this threat by North Korea who could test a hydrogen bomb over the Pacific Ocean, their foreign minister is saying at the moment.
Well, if you were the North Koreans, you would want nuclear weapons, because that's perfectly logical from a military point of view why they want them. And that's because people who don't have nuclear weapons, who the Americans don't like, they end up with a bayonet up their bum like Gaddafi. And Kim Jong-un does not end up like that. And therefore, they have made a perfectly rational decision to get nuclear weapons. The same reason Britain's got nuclear weapons. It's an insurance policy, isn't it? And it's, and people can huff and they can puff, but it's perfectly logical why they want them. And the way to stop them testing them is to negotiate with them. Stop having all of these huge drills where you pretend to invade North Korea, which happened every year, and the North Koreans say, if you carry on, you know, threatening to invade us, we're only a small country, the obvious solution for us is to have a nuclear weapon. That's what you'd do if you were us, and we would.
Now, this week there was a ballistic missile test by Iran. Only thing was, it never actually happened. It was reported all around the world, and then I think it was Newsweek or one of the big American news outlets pointed out that this is fake news. It's footage from 7 years ago, and yet Trump was condemning it, even though it had never actually happened.
Well, this is because we're not only are we facing off in a confrontation with the North Koreans, we're facing off a confrontation with the Iranians.
Isn't the news media actually really to blame here? Because what if they say, oh, there's been a nuclear bomb go off somewhere, and Trump believes them?
Well, what's happening is that Trump is being led by the nose by the military-industrial complex. So he puts his own spin on it all as well. So it's doubly dangerous. The military-industrial complex has got a pretty dangerous long-run strategy, and having somebody like Trump in charge, who just fires from the hip without thinking, also adds to the dangers. I mean, the North Koreans, we just mentioned them a minute ago, they've said, after Trump said that he would destroy North Korea, they said, well, right, if we think that you're about to attack us, we will respond immediately with nuclear weapons. They've made that clear. Now, in other words, any miscalculation now will lead to a nuclear war because of Trump's big mouth, if nothing else.
I mean, fake news does seem to be coming from all sorts of different directions, not just from one. Certainly, it's not just bloggers that are producing fake news, and it's not just presidents that are producing fake news, and it's not just major media that are producing it. I think this is just goes back to the rigour of journalism, checking your facts and that sort of thing. And somebody that's done, I think, a brilliant job in checking facts, which the mainstream media haven't done, is Michael Tyler. He's on our Dialect show next Tuesday at noon. But here's a short extract from him talking about a slightly different subject, which is the way that even though he's done this investigation into the deaths of 80 bankers over the last 3 years on his blog, that for some reason Google have now completely wiped him out from their index. If you search for his blog now, some of the pages may possibly pop up, some of the images, but all the key stuff, what he's saying is that Google have just disappeared him.
Well, what Google are doing is censoring the net, and everybody's got to be very well aware of it. And it's had a massive effect on all sorts of very reputable websites of both left and right, which try and tell the truth and try and get to the bottom of things. Their hits have gone down massively since this April algo was brought in by Google. And I think people need to be aware that when you put a search into Google, you're not going to get a genuinely independent search for what's there. You're going to get somebody's version of what they want you to think.
So, yeah, here's Michael Tyler, and he's not talking just about censorship, for example, of his website and other websites. He's talking about demonetization. That is to say, people who've been successful on YouTube and maybe through Google Ads are now being told, oh, well, because we don't like your content, or they're not being told this, but this is what's happening, because we don't like what you're saying, we will no longer allow adverts on your stuff. And so, of course, their entire living. I mean, this is Luke We Are Change, for example, from New York. He was massively successful on YouTube, and he was actually making a reasonable amount of money because he was getting so many hits by going up and doorstepping some major leaders, people like Kissinger, and asking them difficult questions, which the mainstream media weren't. People like him are now being demonetized by Google, who own YouTube.
Well, that's right. And at the same time, if you are, you know, a dissident in Russia opposing the Russian government, you're probably on a salary of 50 grand a year paid for by the US taxpayer. Meanwhile, Google, which is, and YouTube, which are working closely with the US government, are depriving independent journalists in the West of a living.
Another thing Michael points out is that some of the big tech companies and big media have been buying up smaller websites only to close them down.
Well, that's the logic of concentration, isn't it? And I think underlying all
they're
of this...
They're bribing you, basically, to remove your content from the internet.
Yeah, well, underlying all of this is the whole concept of STRATCOM, strategic communications and psychological warfare, hybrid war. And, of course, the truth in journalism is sacrosanct. You know, opinion is free, but the truth, but facts are sacred.
Well, we've got a page on our website, haven't we? And if you go to thisweek.org.uk, you'll find a little link at the top to it, which is Diamonds in the Cesspool, a term suggested by our friend Glenn from Luton, which is, I think, a great term. But also on there, I think tonight what I'll do is I'll put links to some of the other search engines that you can use, not necessarily Google, because they're now effectively censoring the truth. So when the mainstream press are lying, a blogger, Martin, is telling the truth and explaining what's really going on, Google delists them from their index.
Well, the reason they're doing this is because they're rattled, and they know that they can't necessarily control the narrative in the way they used to, so they're now using these dirty tricks to make sure that they can try and control the narrative. And of course, that's a red light flashing that we're probably going to end up in a full-on shooting war with everybody lying through their teeth.
So did you hear that, Google? We're on to you. Yeah, we know you're lying. So here's Michael Tyler now from his point of view. I mean, I just think it's frightening and incredible that people like him, even the brilliant work he's done on the murder of all these top bankers, are being delisted.
It's censorship. Well, I've got like a couple of people, Dave Rubin. He was a presenter, and he was someone that had, you know, he'd made his own career before he moved on to the new media. And he basically went on as a new way, like Trump tweets, he kind of got on there, and it was something that really worked for him. And he'd based, you know, this is now the extent of his income, I'd guess. So he found himself demonetized, and he's you can look him up, his name's Dave Rubin. He did a feature on Sky. Tucker Carlson did an interview on Sky with him. And he's, you know, he's basically just had his life removed. Another person called Jacqueline Glenn, very, very popular YouTube, just as a magazine. Again, her whole life just removed. I ran a website and it got bought by the BBC, and they just completely removed it. And these people, there's another story about Forbes, again, just completely remove it. You know, if they don't like you, it's not the first time they've done it. Google have been doing this for a long, long time.
So that's Michael Tyler there. You can find him at michaeltyler.co.uk, but not necessarily going to find him by putting his name into Google. You might do, but certainly some of his images and his pages have been completely removed, Martin.
Well, this is, and obviously there's a Gallup. This has happened in the last few months, and people need to be aware of it.
I mean, the dead bankers, I'll just ask you to guess, if you can, which the three major banks, which they're from. Have a guess. Which are the major banks?
Deutsche Bank.
Very good. Number one, yep.
Barclays?
Nope.
I can't guess.
JP Morgan's another one, UBS is another UBS, one. But okay. There's tens of bankers that have been found suicided, effectively, where there's been no proper police investigation into them at these major banks. You would have thought that one of the mainstream media outlets in the West would have taken some vague interest in this story, but they haven't. Instead, Michael's page is being closed down by Google.
Well, that's because there's more going on here than meets the eye. And people who think that the mainstream news, what the mainstream news usually does is distortion by omission. It's what Brian Eno calls propaganda. We're given things to worry about, things that we should be concerned about, and we spend our time worrying about these basically confected arguments. And then the real, and then of course, really important stuff is just not there, which means that people got a very distorted view of the way the world works, because really important things are hardly ever covered, and lots of very trivial stuff is given blanket coverage. And that, and you know, that's the way they control people's
what's
minds.
What's the significance of bankers being murdered then? Why is it important?
Well, it's hard to know. It could be that they know more than they ought to. So it could be that they're not connected murders.
I mean, you
know,
you
it could be that it could be that it's such a dirty industry, a bit like drug traffic, that these people are just being murdered not because the same. It's not the same force
the actual,
at work. It's just a very dangerous industry to work in.
The actual rate seems to have fallen off now, but there seems to have been a couple of years where there's an incredible number of these murders going on. And I mean, you have to say that because you look at the circumstances in which these people have died. For example, we had one of them was shot, as he explains, multiple times with a nail gun whilst in the bath. Doesn't, I mean, on the surface of it, it looks like a murder, but the police have treated it on the surface of it as suicide.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have followed the story a bit, but I haven't followed it in full detail. It could be that all of these murders are connected. It could be, as I say, that the industry is just a dangerous industry. You know, tens of thousands of people have died in Mexico because of drug traffic, and it's not all down to one evil force. It's to do with the nature of the industry that we're talking about. And in banking, where there's all sorts of skullduggery going on, there's all sorts of motives why people might be bumped
maybe
off.
Maybe these ones being bumped off are thinking about being honest, maybe.
Well, maybe that's what's going on, and maybe there, you know, there could be different reasons in each case. That's the, you know, you can't presume, but of course what it shows is that
you can't presume all 80 are in any way connected.
No, you can't presume they are. They might be, and that's open for discussion. It's certainly a big coincidence.
It's not open for discussion when Google censors it, is it?
Well, no, and that's right, and that's the problem, is we're not being allowed to discuss it, and that's completely unacceptable.
Okay, also, let's move on to have a look at the referendum. I mean, do you think they should? I mean, the central government in Madrid has tried to stop this referendum in Barcelona and Catalonia. Do you think it should be allowed to go on?
Well, it's pretty silly of them, actually, because the opinion polls show that if there was a referendum, a bit like the Scots referendum a few years ago here, there's a majority who probably want to keep the status quo. 70% of people in Catalonia have said that they want a referendum, but only 41% seem to be keen on independence. And if the central government was more democratic and kept its nerve, they say, OK, have the referendum, and then if the Catalonians voted to remain in Spain, that would settle it for quite a long time to come. But, of course, what they're doing now with trying to repress the referendum on Sunday is it's going to turn into an awful mess, and it's quite possible that at the end of this, Catalonia will be independent when it wouldn't have been otherwise if the government in Madrid had shown more common sense.
I mean, the government in Madrid seems to have done all they can to stop it, confiscating ballot papers, all this sort of thing.
Well, all that means is eventually you're going to get people's backs up. I mean, the same sort of thing was said by Gorbachev to the Lithuanians in 1991, was said by the Serbs to the Kosovans, and then we went to war, if you remember, and killed thousands and thousands of civilians so that Kosovo could be independent of Serbia, even though it had never been independent of Serbia previously. And, you know, obviously we've got the Kurdish referendum in Iraq, which has been opposed by everybody apart from the Israelis.
Wouldn't it make sense to have referenda actually more often, so that it became just a routine thing, that everybody said, oh, yes, of course, for example, for Wales, there maybe every 10, 15, 20 years that the Welsh said, yes, we are still happy to be associated. I mean, that's what democracy means, isn't it?
Well, it is, but to be honest with you, I'm not a big fan of referenda. You should only use them when it's appropriate. Referenda are often a very, very crude mechanism for resolving disputes.
It does concentrate the minds of the central government, doesn't it? To say, make sure that there are enough resources sent to the regions. I mean, this is one of the problems, is that the power gets concentrated, and money gets concentrated, and the spending of that money gets concentrated in the centre.
Yeah, but what also happens is that wealthy regions want to break away because they feel that they're subsidising poorer regions, which is what you saw in Yugoslavia with Slovenia and Croatia in their own perception, and the same, say, with the Liga del Nord in Italy. But of course, you've got to remember that the way capitalist economy works, for example, is that 80% of the graduates in Britain from Scotland, Wales, everywhere, they end up in the southeast of England because that's the way the economy works. So that means that taxpayers in Scotland pay to educate their young people, and then 80% of them leave and never contribute to the Scottish economy. Now, that's the problem, is that the way the capitalist system works is with uneven development, sucking resources in from peripheral regions, and some calls for independence are an attempt to get out of redistributing back to Scotland the money necessary, for example, to educate their graduates, which then come to work in the City of London and contribute to London's prosperity. And I'm not against independence. I think, but everybody has got to approach these things in a rational way, and also be aware that there is always going to be a minority who won't agree with you, and they could declare independence from you. So when Croatia declared independence from Yugoslavia, the Serbs in the Krajina, who'd lived there for hundreds of years, declared independence from Croatia. But eventually they were all driven out by the Croatians, and I drove through the Krajina just after they'd been driven out. It was really shocking. Everybody had gone. They had all been driven out at that weekend. And it was all done with NATO forces supplying weaponry and training to the Croatians. None of those Serbs have ever come back. They've been driven out of the Krajina, even though they lived there hundreds of years.
It's worth talking a bit about Montenegro. I have been there a few weeks ago and actually met up with the nephew of someone who stood to be president of Montenegro, and on election day in October last year at 6 p.m. in the day, there was a news flash: oh, the president has been, there's been an attempt on his life with support from the Russians, Mark.
Yeah, I was asked to talk about this on RT, and of course, there's no real evidence that no attempt was ever made. So this allegation is an allegation. There isn't actually any.
Well, what it's meant is that the opposition has been arrested and they're now involved in this trial.
That's right, and of course, Montenegro took independence from Serbia because they were pressured by the West. You know, there's pro-Western forces that wanted independence from Serbia, even though, because Montenegro provides Serbia with a route to the sea, and of course they all speak Serbo-Croat. They're all, in fact, closely related to the Serbs, and you know, the breakup of Yugoslavia was part of an overall strategy by the West to balkanize Eastern Europe and to create problems for the Russians. So there's got to be some realistic understanding of the dangers of independence and so on. I'm not against it, but is Kashmir going to be independent of India? The Indians don't think so. What if they had a vote in the whole of Ireland about changing the status of Northern Ireland? There's always going to be rows and arguments about this and the potential for ethnic conflict. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have votes on independence, if that's what
this was very important, because
everybody's
Montenegro
got to understand that
Montenegro
it's not just about voting.
Just joined NATO, hasn't it? So it's
that's
very important
right.
that he was in place and not someone else
that's
who
right,
was maybe then, looking to balance between Russia and
well,
the West.
Indeed, and each individual conflict which has got its local roots, whether it's in Kashmir or Sri Lanka or anywhere else, there's also outside forces who are supporting various factions because they've got their own goals. And the big battle between the Western powers and Russia and China underpins virtually everything that's going on in the world today.
Okay, well, one of the big speeches that Jeremy Corbyn made at his conference, the Labour Party conference this week, was about foreign policy.
Terrorism is thriving in a world that, frankly, our governments have helped to shape, with its failed states, military interventions and occupations. Where millions of people are forced to flee conflict or hunger. We have to do better and swap the knee-jerk response of another bombing campaign for long-term help to solve the conflicts rather than fuel them. And we must put our values at the heart of our foreign policy. Democracy and human rights are not an optional extra to be deployed selectively. So we cannot be silent at the cruel Saudi war in Yemen while continuing to supply arms to Saudi Arabia. or the crushing of democracy in Egypt or Bahrain, or the tragic loss of life in the Congo, which the media very seldom bother to report. And I say this today to Aung San Suu Kyi, a champion of democracy and human rights. Please, do all you can to end the violence now against the Rohingya in Myanmar. And allow the United Nations and international aid agencies into Rakhine State. The Rohingya have suffered for too long. We should stand firm for peaceful solutions to international crises. Let's tone down the rhetoric and back dialogue and negotiations to wind down the deeply dangerous confrontation over the Korean Peninsula. And I appeal to the United Nations General Secretary, Antonio Guterres, to use the authority of his office to go to Washington and to go to Pyongyang to kickstart that essential process of dialogue. And let's give real support to end the oppression of the Palestinian people. The 50-year occupation and illegal settlement expansion and move to a genuine two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict. Britain's voice needs to be heard independently in the world, and we must be a candid friend of the United States now more than ever. The values we share are not served by building walls. Banning immigrants on the basis of religion, polluting the planet, or pandering to racism. And let me say frankly, conference, the speech made by the United States President to the UN last week was disturbing. It threatened war and talked of tearing up international agreements. Devoid of concern for human rights and universal values, it really wasn't a speech that should have been made. Our government has a responsibility. It cannot meekly go along with this dangerous course. If the special relationship means anything, it must mean that we can say to Washington, that way is the wrong way.
Well, obviously what we can hear there is that the audience at Labour Party conference are quite pleased to hear what Jeremy Corbyn's saying. And of course it's a relief to have that kind of rhetoric coming from the platform after the Blair years, when many Labour activists like me felt that the leadership had completely betrayed the fundamental internationalist values that drive the Labour Party and makes us rather unique, in fact, in world politics. We're not a nationalist party in the traditional sense of the word at all. We are an internationalist party with an international perspective. We've always had that. And Jeremy Corbyn, of course, is following in the footsteps perhaps of Robin Cook, is reminding the delegates of what the Labour Party has always aspired to stand for. Not always, of course.
But local MP Kerry McCarthy called him a cult leader.
Well, that was then and this is now. I'm not sure she'd say that today. I think what's happened is that Jeremy Corbyn has won over his critics in the Labour Party to a large extent because of his success of getting his message over. And I think what he's doing is emboldening people to be bold about saying what needs to change in this country in terms of foreign policy and other policies. And it's not pie in the sky. This is an inflection point in world affairs. And it's about time we stepped up to the plate and played a big role in trying to make the world a more peaceful place. And Britain has a key role in all of that.
Can Britain take on Trump and win?
We don't have to take on Trump and win, but we certainly have to tell him a few home truths that he needs to hear. And we're certainly not going to back him in a war with Iran or a war with North Korea. And if he thinks that the British people are ready to go to war with either North Korea or Iran, he's deluded. We're not.
BCFM. Now, tonight, it's the premiere of a film which is called In My Mind. It's actually a look back at a series from 50 years ago. It's exactly 50 years ago tonight that it first aired on the television. It's called The Prisoner, and there's a film which has just literally had its premiere up in Port Merion, where the series was filmed, this evening. And the film was made by Chris Rodley. We'll be hearing from him in a moment, but right now let's have a little listen to an extract from the film where Patrick McGoohan, who's the number six, he plays number six in The Prisoner, he talks about how he got started in television, doing drama, TV drama, live TV drama, if you can imagine that. I imagine doing a live television drama for like an hour and a half. Anything that goes wrong, everyone's going to see you, in the 1950s and 1960s, where he cut his teeth as a TV actor.
I had been doing a number of TV plays, a whole string of them, in the days when they were live. In other words, when it said in the studio, vision on, you were exposed to the millions or however many that were watching, and if you made a mistake, you didn't have the privilege of going back and picking it up and correcting it. So it was very exciting, good for the adrenaline. One of the plays that I did was a play called The Big Knife by Clifford Odets, in which I played an aging movie star. And Lou Grade saw it, and at the time they were looking for someone to be in a new series that they were preparing called Danger Man.
Every government has its Secret Service branch. America, it's CIA, France, Deuxième Bureau, England, MI5. A messy job? Well, that's when they usually call on me or someone like me. Oh, yes. My name is Drake. John Drake.
He felt that it was a very stereotypic, Bond-like character that was womanizer, carried a gun, and shot people. He didn't want to play someone that was full of himself. I can tell you that. He was good-looking, but it wasn't just his looks. You knew that he was always thinking, and you could always see in a scene he was always working things out. He also moved very, very well. In fact, Lou Grade described it that he moved like a panther. He was firm and decisive. Other people have described it as he was defiant in every way.
He can make even the act of putting on his dressing gown appear as a gesture of defiance.
So there's a clip there from the film In My Mind by Chris Rodley, and I hope I'm joined on the line now by Chris from Port Merion. Hi, Chris, and welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. I hope you can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you fine. Can you tell us what first got you interested in this series? Because I know watching the film the other night, absolutely fascinating to see that you actually were part of the kind of original, one of the first programmes in the first few years of Channel 4. So what first gave you the inspiration to go and make the original interviews with Patrick McGoohan about the series?
I think because I'm very, very old, and I saw it when it went out originally in 1967 and 68, and I was you know, I'm just studying for A levels, and I'd never seen anything quite like it, and I'd never ever forgot it. I mean, I think there were things about it which, it's a cliche, but they're like indelible, and they make indelible marks on your mind. And so many years later, when Channel 4 started, and pretty much everyone and his little brother could get a gig there, because there were very heady days, I wrote a treatment for a film about the prisoner, and even though I'd never made any television in my life, 2 days after I sent them the treatment, they called me up, said, come in. I went in. They said, we're going to make it. But you don't know anything about it, do you, about television? I said, no. They said, well, don't worry. We'll put you with a producer and a director, and all will be well. And within 10 days, I was in America for the very first time, interviewing someone who had been my hero since I was a teenager. I mean, it was that kind of easy.
But it wasn't. Weird. It didn't go too well, did it? It was actually, I thought your film was, honestly saying this, a wonderful piece of filmmaking, because you managed to convey the fact that, obviously, as interviewing Patrick McGoohan, you're going to have to kind of sit him down, tell him what to do, and he wasn't having it, was he? It almost like the prisoner, number six, the character in his series.
Yeah, no, he wasn't having any of it. I think we all severely underestimated him. We should have guessed. I mean, he is number six. He is those characters. That's not a cat. I mean, it's him. So I think the problem was, it was my first ever film, and I was a fan, and I was easily intimidated. And when you're sitting with your hero and he's screaming at you, telling you, you know, this is how it's going to be, it's difficult. It was a very, very, very difficult experience. Although, you know, I never didn't stop loving him in a way, but he didn't make life easy. That wasn't his job, and quite right. I mean, he saw me coming. I think he is a very inexperienced person he's well-meaning. He loves my work, but he doesn't know what he's doing. So we better help him make a film properly, which he tried to do. But It was tough.
Well, one of the things that most fascinated me was the way that you filmed this interview with him, where he kind of finished in an empty house, and he switches the lights off and said, be seeing you at the end of it. And you go off thinking that you finished the film, and he's secretly managed to follow you to another destination. And then, so what, tell us about that. It was absolutely amazing. It was almost like, must have been like being in the middle of some kind of spy movie.
Yeah. Absolutely true. We finished filming. Tonight said, well, let's, you know, that was tough, but let's go treat ourselves to a few days in the Mojave Desert. We drove off to the desert. I still don't know how he found us, but we were in our hotel and the phone rang and it was him, and he was already just down the road. I mean, that sort of way of wrong-footing you. He said, I'm here. Come talk to me now. And he tried to buy all the footage back from us. I honestly don't know how he found us. It doesn't sound possible. Unless he followed us, literally, I don't know how he did that. I didn't even ask him. I didn't have the courage even or the nerve to ask, how did you find us? But he found us somehow. I don't know how.
Okay, can you tell us what's been going on up at Port Merion today then?
Yeah, there's been, because the prisoner was first shown literally 50 years ago today, to this date. So there's been screenings of, well, there's my film, the screenings of other episodes of The Prisoner, and people, the very, very few people who are still alive who were in the show. Some of them are here. So they've been screening some episodes, there have been Q&As, and they're still going on. They're going to be showing the first episode to the minute, actually, I think, to the minute that it was shown, literally. And they even put it showing contemporary ads to keep it absolutely in time. I mean, it's a series that I guess, produces that kind of fanaticism and that kind of dedication. I mean, it doesn't happen for The Saint, obviously, and many other series. It's sort of fetishized. It's very strange.
I mean, I think that's a bit unfair, I think, because I certainly remember when I first watched it, I thought, well, this is fascinating. I don't understand it, but maybe one day I will.
Yeah.
A lot of depth to the program. And I think the other thing is the ending was very controversial at the time. I wonder if you could just explain why it was, because the series the idea was that he was going to try and break out of this village, but then he never managed to. So tell us a bit about the controversy and why so many people were phoning up the ITV at the time, the network centre, to complain.
Well, I think because it set up some basic questions. One was, why did you resign? And he wasn't telling you. And who is number one? And no one was saying who number one was. You only ever saw number two, the sidekicks. And so I think people thought for the last episode, they would find out why he had resigned, what his real name was, and who the hell number one was. And they didn't find out any of those things. Well, they found out that number one was him. That him, the baddie and the goodie were the same person. So the controversy was because there was no meat. It was
Sorry, we were losing you there, Chris. If you could just maybe you could just say that again. I mean, what was going on there? It was because, I mean, just trying to read into it. It was because what McGoohan was trying to say with the series is that the biggest problems with paranoia and with control and with fear are actually within ourselves, within our own minds, which I think is actually quite a profound statement.
Absolutely. It's just a unique statement from Lou Grade and ITC and from a kind of company that gave you The Saint and Danger Man and Man in a Suitcase and The Baron and The Persuaders. I mean, it was an ambitious kind of a thinking man's program, which was dressed up as a kind of spy series. So I think people were confused. Is it a spy series or is it some almost like a theater piece, like a very ambitious intellectual piece of work, which it was. And so I think they got confused because it was two things at the same time. So he wanted to deliver an important message, which is our biggest enemy is ourselves. But he did it in the clothing of the spy genre. And I think, you know, you don't expect that of James Bond. You don't expect to go to a James Bond movie and be thrust into all kinds of existential angst about what's wrong with the world and are you your own worst enemy. You know, you expect girls and guns and sex and lots of fast cars.
Well, let's just have another clip from it now.
I'd be very, very angry and disappointed if they hadn't watched, if they hadn't jammed the switchboards at ATV. I would have been outraged. I would have slunk around for years with my tail between my legs, instead of which it was just terrific. Loved it. And if I can do that again, I'll do it again. God love them. Watch it. Millions of them. And be outraged. As long as people feel something. That's the great thing. It's when they're walking around not thinking and not feeling. That's tough. That's where all the dangerous stuff is. Because when you get a mob like that, you can turn them into the sort of gang that Hitler had. We don't want that. We want people who say, hey, now, wait a minute. You dare do that to me? I felt that it was sort of designed for 1984, and it's ironic in some ways that it's running in England again, the tail end of 83, and I believe into 84. 2000 and something, I don't know, maybe one or two people might want to see it then.
One of the things that McGoohan also says in there, that he was very pleased at the way the series actually made people think. People sort of wander around like zombies and they're not really thinking enough. And this series was designed to make them think. Anyway, it certainly is one of the best TV dramas ever produced in Britain. But why is it that we're not making... We haven't kind of moved on, it seems, Chris. We haven't actually made anything better since.
No, it's unfortunate. We don't have any Lou Grades. It's as simple as that. I mean, I think people thought, I don't know what people thought or think about Lou Grade because he did, you know, Sunday Night, the London Palladium, but he also gave Sir Kenneth Clark his first break in television. Unfortunately, we don't have entrepreneurs like Lou Grade. That's one very good reason why we're not doing better. We have a lot of very, very mediocre people running television, commissioning stuff. No one with the flair and the risk taking that Lou Grade had.
I mean, do you think there's anywhere now for writers who really do want to do some challenging dramas? Anywhere for them to go nowadays?
I think you can do challenging drama. We have lots of challenging drama. We just don't have anything with quite the edge. You know, we have lots of very, very thinky, you know, complicated television in the way that we didn't have. I mean, television now, a lot of American actors will tell you they just want to be in TV. They don't want to be in movies because movies are so impoverished and thin. So we have lots of thinky, good television. We just don't have anything quite as edgy as The Prisoner, I think, or as fantastical. I mean, missing is real imagination. We've got a lot of very, very good and very realistic, dreary drama, which is fine. I love it.
Also, I mean, amazing that the series, what it does is it sort of sucks you in, kind of lures you into a full sense of understanding what's going on, and then kind of faces you at the end with all these kind of home truths. But anyway, look, in my mind, great little film, Chris. I must compliment you on it, having been privileged enough to watch it the other day. And I just wonder, whereabouts can people get hold of this? And is there going to be a sort of new release of the series or something on DVD or elsewhere?
Yeah, there's on the whole reissue.
The wonders of Skype, eh? I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to wherever you can get hold of In My Mind. I would imagine, I think it's been organised by Network who sell this stuff on DVD, and I imagine it would be being released as a part of a package to do with a new DVD release of the series. But anyway, even though I'm not sure if you can still hear me, Chris, line having gone down to Port Merion, thanks very much for joining us on the politics show. Martin, this program, what it does is there are all sorts of phrases in it that suggest that the secret services aren't all what they seem. And it was quite fascinating to see that within Britain there was enough kind of momentum within TV drama to say, let's actually do a series which is really critical of the secret services, and let's do a series which is looking ahead at the potential for the abuse, the fascistic abuse of surveillance.
Well, what can I say? I do remember the series when I saw it when I was a child. We used to watch it. I can't claim that I understood it, and I think it was originally based upon a real place that used to be used in World War II, where people who had been, you know, fallen out with the secret services were taken to be, you know, debriefed and
with George Markstein, he was I think the script editor of the program, and he introduced some of the themes through the series. George Markstein wrote a book called The Cooler, which was based on fact, where there are various types agents that had been trained to go and work in, be dropped into occupied Europe. But then they realised that, well, these people are either too crazy or they know something they shouldn't know. So they had to go and send them for effectively indefinite training up in Scotland, Inverlair Lodge, I think it was called, a place up near, up in the Highlands, I imagine, somewhere. But anyway, so yes, it's based on something real. But also, I mean, the thing is, it's bringing people into this Secret Service world and finding out that actually it isn't necessarily as exciting, sexy as it seems.
Well, I think there are fantastical elements in the film. That's what I remember as watching it as a child. I mean, I remember the white balloon that you would capture people by bounding around and landing on top of them. I don't think that was terribly realistic, Tony. So, in other words, you've got to, you know, there's still an element of this. This isn't a documentary about the secret services.
One of the programs, for example, one of the series, is they're trying to find out why he wants to resign. And what they do is they lay him down on a couch, and they are somehow surveying his dreams, and they're going into his dreams. And so in his dreams, they're coming up to him and asking him why he resigned. And then he realizes in the dream, he realizes, oh, my goodness, they've even got into my dreams. They're trying to get information from me that way. But there is a sinister side to this now, and that is this US policy of total information awareness.
Well, I mean, we know that in actual fact the tricks of the trade of spying, we've talked about strategic communications earlier, hybrid warfare, psychological warfare, it's far more sophisticated now and far more intense than it was then, and it was pretty intense then. And of course, fictional dramas like this can help to, you know, conscientize people to what's going on. But I'm afraid I'm a bit of a stickler for factual stuff. I prefer documentaries, and I prefer factual material.
Yeah, but not many people watch those. The Prisoner was watched by tens of millions of people.
Well, that's right, and that's the goal of drama.
And more ever since.
Well, indeed, and drama has got its own justification.
Isn't it fair
anyway?
To say that in drama you can say things that you could never say in, say, for example, a factual article?
That's quite right. So Sybil Edmonds, for example, has written novels about Gladio II because she used to be an FBI translator and so on. She's not trying to write factual books about what's happened. She's trying to write fictional books because they're going to be read more. So that's a tactic.
Well, it might be stretching a point, but I think one of the reasons for all of this is that organised crime are everywhere. We were talking about the Big Four. Deloitte's, KPMG and the rest of them. We've moved beyond a failure in regulation towards an organised assurance that people can get away with crime and no regulators or police are going to come and get them.
Well, that's another huge topic. We've got a criminalised elite which is using psychological warfare to try and dominate the planet, and some documentaries and some drama programs are attempting to, you know, to talk about these topics.
I think, actually, I mean, I was thinking, trying to think to myself, who would write a good sort of prisoner today? Who would be a good writer to write something similar? And, you know, popped into my mind, David Southwell. So let's have a listen to him now talking about how he thinks we should be tackling organised crime at the centre, at the top, actually, of our society.
My name is David Southwell. I'm the author of several books, including History of Organised Crime and Secrets and Lies. I actually really believe that the basis of dismantling organised crime, making an impact on organised crime, it's never about more police numbers, it's never about increased budgets, it is never about increased powers. If you talk to, as I have done, anybody who is highly placed in a transnational criminal organisation, there are two things which really, really worry them. One of which is tackling prohibition, because prohibition is one of the biggest sources of any criminal activity and criminal market. And it's the other really big issue for them is actually making business much more difficult for them to do, which is all about tackling poverty at a local level, tackling poverty at a global level.
Why does that make business more difficult for them?
Because, you know, you're quite often the very nature of organised crime is exploitative. It's very difficult to exploit those who are in secure financial situations. Criminal activity, whether it's illegal immigration operations, illegal prostitution operations, if there isn't a base of poverty, it's very difficult to exploit people. So if you tackle poverty and you tackle prohibition, you're actually undermining criminal enterprises in a way that increased police powers, increased police resources can never hope to do. And one of the guys I interviewed for the History of Organised Crime, there's an Albanian mafia organiser in the UK, a guy called Zef Nano, who was very closely involved in illegal immigration, drug running operations and illegal prostitution in the UK. And he was very clear and very explicit that he would not be able to thrive in terms of what he would see as entrepreneurship if there wasn't a base poverty which he was able to exploit for prostitution and immigration, and if there wasn't prohibition for the drugs. And so for him, the two biggest worries were taking those away, not increasing police powers, you know, not increasing police resources, police numbers. Those have very limited operational problems, which any big transnational criminal organisation can always get around by bribery, other routes, you know, redeploying resources. Actually tackling organised crime is much more fundamental, and it really requires real political bravery, real bravery by us as people to say, you know, we are going to refuse to engage in allowing that level of poverty to exist, that level of prohibition to exist, because those are what permit and allow organised criminal activity to thrive. You want to tackle organised crime, tackle poverty, tackle prohibition.
David Southwell there. And Martin, final topic, spin-off from The Prisoner, is that there are big organisations out there, including there's something called Le Cercle, where big intelligence agencies actually do cooperate together. And so they're really completely out of any kind of democratic control. If you look at it nationally, most intelligence agencies have no control democratically. They just get taxpayers' money. But then they're actually organised in groups like Le Cercle, which is a fascistic group, internationally.
Yeah, well, there's a big overlap between organised crime and intelligence services. So if you think of somebody like Colonel Oliver North in the Iran-Contra affair, he's a big hero on US network TV, but in actual fact, what he was involved with doing, with Adolfo Calero, the head of the Contras, he was basically bringing massive amounts of drugs into the US with the support of the CIA. That's all on the record, but nobody's ever been punished and nobody ever will be punished.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Brislington West, Joss Clark, and Labour Councillor for Avonmouth and Lawrence Weston, Donald Alexander. Thanks also to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers there, and to, what was his name? Oh, Chris Rodley, who's done the film In My Mind about The Prisoner. Also, this show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1991, The With It Boys and Shirley Lewis. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.